From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we listen back to a conversation with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporters on Wisconsin's surprisingly checkered history with women's suffrage. We learn about H.H. Bennett, the man who made the Dells famous.
This was just a stop on the railroad, just a tiny little town, and it's really thanks to H.H. Bennett and his family's support in making these, you know, photographs that really allowed this place to be truly on the map.
Plus, we'll tell you about the creator of SpaghettiOs, a man from Waukesha.
And it was in the 50s when they said, in essence, we need something to compete with this great spaghetti product that Chef Boyardee has. And hey, Gherky, go.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we'll learn about the man who made the Wisconsin Dells famous. We learn about the fight to save Wisconsin's native languages and get a little history on the creator of SpaghettiOs, a man from Waukesha. We'll start with some different Wisconsin history. The first state to ratify the 19th Amendment was none other than Wisconsin. But the state's own history with women's voting rights is a bit complicated. Meg Jones was a reporter and Nancy Stowes, a feature editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They did a series about women's suffrage in Wisconsin to mark the 100th anniversary in 2019. They spoke to Lake Effect's Joy Powers about women's suffrage in Wisconsin, its challenging journey, and the pioneering women who led the way.
Suffrage had been going on in the state of Wisconsin. Women had been trying to get the vote for decades, decades and decades. And it seemed like at every juncture, they were foiled for some reason or another. They would get some people in the legislature to be on their side, but not fully. And then they would get a vote, but it was only for school issues. It was all men in the legislature. The men in the legislature were like, well, you know, women really can't be counted on or can't be trusted with a full vote for, say, president or governor. But, you know, they do have children, so we'll only let them vote in school elections. And so then they vote in school elections, but then some of their votes are tossed out. And then somebody, a woman who did vote, has to file a lawsuit. So it was kind of stops and starts for the state of Wisconsin. So the fact that Wisconsin's the first to ratify the amendment was, it's just very, very interesting and unusual given our previous history.
So when we look at the suffrage movement, really from its beginning in Wisconsin to its ostensibly its end in 1919, what does that look like?
You know, it was interesting when I was doing the research for this, I was amazed at kind of the patchwork quilt across the United States that women's voting rights were. I mean, you had places like Wyoming where 1869, if you're a woman living in Wyoming, you could vote for anybody, for president. And it seemed like the Western states were much more progressive earlier than other states. But Wisconsin was, you know, a lot of the grassroots efforts were from the women's clubs. And women's clubs were very, very popular because that's how women would get together and they would talk about issues of the day. And one of the major issues was suffrage. So in Wisconsin, it was kind of like this. It was two steps forward, one step back. They would get some people within the legislature to approve this, but then it would go to a referendum and all the male voters, because that's all they had, would say no. So it was one of these, when Nancy came to me and said, oh, hey, we should do something on Wisconsin being the first to ratify. And I'm like, really? I didn't know that. And then I didn't know that Wisconsin, like, probably should have been one of the last states to ratify the vote, given our history. And we are first, too, by a paperwork error, too. We should point that out. So what had happened was that the suffragists were trying to affect change within their state. It wasn't happening in Wisconsin. And the national leaders are like, you know what? We have to go to Congress and get Congress to change this. And then it's going to have to go to two-thirds of the states, which at that time was 35. So at some point, this was in kind of the mid teens, the national leaders kind of gave up on Wisconsin. They're like, you know what? It's kind of a hopeless cause. So they took some of the Wisconsin suffragists who were very vocal, Theodora Yeomans and some of those great women, Jesse Jack Cooper, and they started going around the United States to try and get this through Congress. So it gets through Congress. Then it has to go to the 35 states to ratify. So my big question was like, well, why was Wisconsin the first? And it was because the legislature, which, you know, meets a couple of times a year, but then when they're done with their work, they may not meet for another, you know, 6 months or 8 months or the next year. Well, it turned out that year in 1919, the Wisconsin legislature was way behind. So they should have been done, but they were still doing their work. And so the legislature was still in session. So when Congress passed this, there was only, I think, three legislatures, Illinois, Wisconsin. I think Michigan had a special section that they came in. So all of our guys were in the Capitol, and they're like, okay, let's vote on this. But they voted it on in like 11-something. I've got it in the story, 11 a.m. on this particular day on June 10th. But the Illinois legislature, which was also late and was also still in session, they voted on it like less than an hour before. But it's not just enough to vote on it and approve it. You have to get the paperwork out to Washington, D.C. So there was kind of this mad dash. And Ada James, who was one of the suffragists here in Wisconsin, she enlisted her father, who was in the Wisconsin legislature. And by the way, he had introduced a resolution, or it introduced a bill for women to get the right to vote, which ultimately failed. But so she enlists her dad. She's like, Dad, we need you to get out to Washington, D.C. So it's kind of a combination of streetcar, train. He had to leave the Capitol that day. She even gives him her like traveling bag. So basically she's like, here's my suitcase, Dad, go. So he gets out to Washington, D.C., and they've got to go to the State Department. So Illinois gets there first because Illinois had a head start, but Illinois had a paperwork error. So there was something wrong with their paperwork, and they're like, ah, sorry, we can't accept this. And Wisconsin's there, and we're like, well, here's our stuff. So that's
typical.
So that's why I said in the story, like, in a cross-border rivalry that predates the Chicago Bears and the Green Bay Packers, Wisconsin, booyah, got out there first, and we became the first to ratify.
By just a hair, right? So, you know, you mentioned the right to vote in school board races, and one of the pieces that you have out already is about a number of different women who were influential in getting the vote for women, both here in Wisconsin and nationally. And I believe the woman you were talking about is Olympia Brown.
Yeah, so Olympia Brown, she's, and you know what's interesting is that there are fascinating, really powerful women that are all through our history here in the state of Wisconsin, as well as the United States. And Olympia Brown was the first female reverend in the state of Wisconsin. And she's the one who goes to vote at her local polling place in Racine. She's pretty thrilled. She's already been a suffragist. She's been trying to get the vote. So she goes and she votes in Racine. And unbeknownst to her, the attorney general at the time had sent out telegrams to clerks of court in various polling places, particularly urban areas, and said, you know what? I don't think women should be able to vote. And so it was, some women were able to vote. Some were turned away from the polls. Some voted, but then their votes were tossed out. And that's what happened to Olympia Brown. And she's like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. This isn't right. I'm a woman and I'm allowed to vote. So she files a lawsuit and a circuit judge agrees with her. But then it's appealed and it goes to the state Supreme Court. And the state Supreme Court does not side with her. The state Supreme Court rules, and this is in like mid-1880s, and they say, well, you know what? Wisconsin's law that allows women to vote only in school elections is vague, and it needs to be rewritten. So basically, they throw the ball back into the legislature's court, where it sits in the legislature's court for like the next decade. So women get to vote in that election, but then they don't get to vote for a while longer. And so Olympia Brown is one of the ones who was like, you know, wait a minute, I'm just not going to go quietly often in the night. I'm going to file a lawsuit. And yeah, ultimately it didn't work for her, but she was one of those voices. And I think you had enough of those voices coming together that got loud enough that finally finally women got the vote.
Well, the other thing that happened was one reason Wisconsin was so opposed to women's suffrage is because a lot of the suffragists were also in favor of or part of the temperance movement. And with all the German beer drinkers, brewers in the state, the Tavern League, they were very much against that. So by the time the amendment was up for ratification, prohibition had already been put in place. So they had nothing more to lose. That was one of the reasons they were able to vote for the amendment.
Interesting. So a big part of it ended up being what is still a major industry for us, alcohol.
Yes.
You know, you mentioned a number of other women inside of that piece, some of whom were actually national figures. I'm thinking in particular, Carrie Chapman Catt.
Yes. So she was from Ripon, I believe, and she became kind of one of the handpicked successors to Susan B. Anthony, kind of brought her along, and Susan B. Anthony kind of picked her to be kind of a successor to her. And she grew up here in Wisconsin. Is that correct?
She was a native of Wisconsin.
Native of Wisconsin, but then she left. So what she did, and what I ended up putting in the story is she had this really, really interesting speech. So Susan B. Anthony said, listen, I need you to go and speak before Congress. So she did in like 1910, 1912, and then she went again in 1917. And her speech in 1917, which I was able to quote a bit in one of the bios, she makes the point. She said, you know, listen, the foundation of our country is that we were against taxation without representation. Okay, that's why we dumped all the tea into the Boston Harbor. But we still have taxation without representation because women are paying taxes. We are paying taxes, and yet we cannot vote for the representatives who are in charge of us. And so she was able to call them out on their hypocrisy, and plenty of people had been calling them out on their hypocrisy, on women being taxed, women being ruled, but not being allowed to vote. And so she was one of these great shining lights who was able to distill this all into several short sentences that basically just kind of, I think, kind of drove a dagger through the heart of efforts to prevent women from voting. And then I'm pretty sure she was the first, then she became the first national president of League of Women Voters. Yeah.
So, yeah, she was the founder and president of the League of Women
Voters.
Yeah,
so what had happened was that they had this national women's suffrage group, and then once they got suffrage, then it very quickly morphed into the League of Women Voters, which, of course, is still very active and very vocal today.
Well, thank you both so much for speaking with us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Our pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Nancy Stowes is a former features editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Meg Jones was a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter who passed away in 2020. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about women's suffrage in 2019. Before the Wisconsin Dells became a tourist destination, it was just a railroad stop known as Kilbourne City. That all changed with H.H. Bennett. The photographer opened a studio there in 1865, and soon his landscape photos of the area helped make it into a top tourist destination. Jenna Loda Eddy is the Visitor Services Coordinator at the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum. We spoke with her last summer to find out more about the man behind the lens.
H.H. really made the Dells area in general famous due to his incredible landscape photography. He was here in the mid to late 1800s and really put the Wisconsin Dells area on the map to tourists around the country.
With his landscapes photography, can you describe the Dells region's landscape that made it so appealing, not just to him as a photographer, but for people to come and see it firsthand?
Oh, certainly. So our area is really unique. We have the beautiful Wisconsin River flowing right through the area. And with that came the formation of these rocks, which come from the French, the French voyageurs, called them dalles, which is apparently translated as kind of a rapid, rocky area of a river. And so that kind of in time translated to Dells, D-E-L-L-S. And that's in reference to these extremely, you know, incredible rock formations that are just not seen very much around the world. So it's very unique to have them right here in the middle of Wisconsin.
During the time that H.H. Bennett was capturing these and making the Dells a place to visit, was landscape tourism really widespread in the U.S. during this time? Or do you think the Dells is one of the first examples of landscapes being a big draw and a big explosive popularity item?
So photography of landscapes was becoming popular really kind of at that same time. So what HH was doing was really on trend with what we were seeing around the country, but it was so important to this area because when you think of landscape photography, you think out west, you know, you think of what became national parks and things like that. So to have little old Wisconsin Dells be part of that incredible experience, you know, if you were a well-to-do family and had the means, you would maybe go to Niagara Falls, which is just incredible. But those who didn't have the means or just simply weren't interested in traveling that far, given the time period, the Wisconsin Dells area, it was known as Kilbourne City at the time, was a really great alternative and had its, you know, its own beauty as well.
H.H. Bennett opened a photography studio there in 1865, and I'm curious how common were spaces like a photography studio during that time?
Well, honestly, not very common in an area such as this. You saw photography studios much more prevalent in the larger communities, larger cities, of course, which makes sense. So for a photography studio to actually already be established here was pretty incredible. The town was very new still. And that studio in 1865 that he opened was actually already established by a gentleman named Leroy Gates, whom he purchased it from, rented it from, in fact, first. And so the fact that he had already established something and was able to slide right into that was really unique, frankly.
And the studio building was first built in 1865, and then Bennett built a new one in 1875, clearly able to sustain this. So has the latest studio, the one built in 1875, if we want to call it the latest, has that remained as a space for H.H. Bennett throughout this whole time, or has the building had a few different lives before it's been under the Wisconsin Historical Society?
That's a really great question, because the answer is pretty unique when it comes to the rest of the buildings in downtown Wisconsin Dells. The historic studio built in 1875 has always been a photography studio, which is not really very common in many small towns, historic towns with a lot of history, especially the buildings surrounding us. So we're very unique in that sense that the 1875 historic studio was built purposely for H.H. Bennett's photography. And then the family ran it as a photography studio all the way through to about 1998, when they then handed it off to the Wisconsin Historical Society, and we've been maintaining it ever since.
That's definitely a unique and incredible legacy to have, especially in the Dells. And another thing H.H. Bennett was known for, and of course a sign of the time, was the wet plate photography method. So could you describe to me what the wet plate method is and some of the things that, you know, we could imagine him being surrounded by?
Yeah, well, it's funny that you say that actually, because we do wet plate photography here in our studio. It's called the Tintype Experience, and we do bring those sights and those smells, some of which are somewhat intense, back to this very historic studio. So you're really getting that full experience of what our studio was and what we're striving to do still today. It was a complex process. Wet plate photography, you pour an organic mixture onto a plate, you dip it in another chemical called silver nitrate that makes it sensitive to light. Then you take your photograph, you go back into that dark room, you pour more chemistry on it, and then you pour even more chemistry on it. So it's very complicated. There are some distinct smells like ether that you would smell, you know, that would be kind of harsh smells, some might think. So it was definitely a multi-sensory experience, to say the least.
So did that make his landscape photography even a little more admirable, considering the long process it would take and to be out in the field doing this kind of technique? It's not a quick process.
Absolutely. You're 100% right. So for him to go out into nature and take these incredible landscape photographs was a process, to say the least. In fact, he had to take all of his equipment with him, any cameras he wanted to use, any glass plates that he wanted to create those negatives, tripods, you know, things like that, his lenses, multiple lenses. But he also had to take a portable darkroom with him because he did not have time to come all the way back to his studio to develop those plates right in his, you know, brick and mortar studio. He had to have a portable one with him. The process took, if everything was going well, about 15 minutes per photograph. So you think of digital modern photography today and how many photographs a modern photographer might be able to take in 15 minutes compared to H.H. Bennett's one. So the commitment that he had to his artistry, to his photography, was quite impressive.
He was also an inventor. So what are some of his inventions and innovations that have impacted us or impacted the world of photography specifically?
Sure. So he was always tinkering. He was always trying to improve himself and his photography. And so when he started taking stereoscopic views, he found that creating a sort of guillotine for the lenses was much more beneficial instead of fumbling around with lens caps. There was no button to take photographs. You simply took the lens cap off and put it back on at that time. So to have a guillotine to create a very sharp kind of on and then off kind of idea to create as crisp and as clean of a photograph and as similar as possible as well, which was very important for stereoscopic views. That was one of many little tinkerings and advancements that he created, along with his rotating print house, which from what we found doesn't really exist anywhere else. This was kind of him. He actually created a rotating print house so he didn't have to move all of his prints as the sun moved around. And most noteworthy is probably his snapper shutter, his instantaneous shutter. Unfortunately, we don't have a patent with his name on it. This technology was brand new at the time, and he was very well read when it came to the advancements of photography and things that were kind of on the cusp. So he always wanted to stay right at that edge. But we do believe that he would have used that technology that was right in existence to fit his own needs. So his snapper shutter, his instantaneous shutter that he used to capture Leaping the Chasm, a kind of iconic shot for this area, was likely his own tinkering and adjustments.
How do you believe the legacy and place of H.H. Bennett has impacted or stuck with people who visit the Dells and obviously today see a very different entertainment landscape captured compared to the time when H.H. Bennett was there?
Certainly. Well, H.H. and his photography kind of started it all. You know, I mean, this was just a stop on the railroad, just a tiny little town. And it's really thanks to H.H. Bennett and his family's support in making these, you know, photographs that really allowed this place to be truly on the map. And of course, it's changed, as you mentioned, time and time again. But as I like to clarify, you know, the water parks can be anywhere. It's the natural landscape, what literally exists in this area in that sense, that really brought guests here and created that idea and that trend that just built from there to what we have now.
Do you have a favorite photo of his or plate that you get to see every day?
Oh gosh, asking me for a favorite is always a challenge. You know, you can't deny the iconic Leaping the Chasm photograph, but I do like the Dell Queen is a steamboat coming through the Narrows. There are two ladies sitting on the rocks in the foreground, and they're just dressed in beautiful Victorian fashion. And it just, for me, really, really captures the time period that H.H. Bennett was photographing in addition to this beautiful landscape that we have here.
Definitely. Well, Jenna, thank you so much for your time and for sharing a little bit about H.H. Bennett with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Audrey. I appreciate it.
Jenna Loda Eddy is the Visitor Services Coordinator at H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum. We spoke in July of 2020 as Bennett Studio celebrated its 145th anniversary. Did you know the inventor of SpaghettiOs is from right here in Wisconsin? Well, we'll tell you more about him and the rise of the popular canned food in about 12 minutes. But first, we learn about the ways schools are working to preserve Wisconsin's native languages. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thousands of years before white settlers came here, Native American tribes lived in the areas throughout Wisconsin. Today, tribes continue to make their homes here, but much has changed. Through decades of forced assimilation, Native American cultures were suppressed, including their languages. Some Native languages are now considered extinct. Tom Tolan is the managing editor for Milwaukee Magazine, and in 2019, he wrote a piece about the efforts to preserve Native languages. He spoke to Lake Effect's Joy Powers about it.
At least five languages are spoken in Wisconsin. There's a couple others that are there are attempts at reviving them, but I wouldn't say they're really spoken.
Yeah, what was surprising in reading the article was, you know, you mentioned the five languages, and then you mentioned like how many first language speakers there are. And I knew it was going to be a small amount, but I was very surprised at how small on some of them.
Five and for the Menominee and seven for the Potawatomi, I think it was. And maybe 35 or 40 for the Ojibwe, who are a much bigger tribe than all the others. But the vast majority of their first language speakers are up in Canada, where there's a number of bands scattered around the country.
Well, and this article is really touching on the effort to change that.
Right.
So you focus on all of these immersion schools. For people who might not be familiar with them as they pertain to language, what is an immersion school?
Well, we have some in Milwaukee. We've got the French language immersion school. I think there's a German one in MPS and Spanish. So, for example, a Fratney school in the River West neighborhood, one day they're doing all their classes in Spanish, and another day they're doing all of them in English. Well, this one at the Lacouture Ojibwe Reservation, the Waduka Dating School is the immersion school there, and they're speaking only Ojibwe. The teachers are speaking only Ojibwe during class time. I think for the younger grades, the kids aren't fluent in Ojibwe yet, or aren't conversant in Ojibwe, so they're allowed to speak a little English in their classes. But the idea is to get them used to using the language, and by the time they graduate, they're conversational in that language.
For most of the students, this is not a language that they're going home and speaking, although they may be Ojibwe. What happened to the Ojibwe language and many Native American languages that caused them to become either extinct in some cases or endangered?
Well, part of it is the United States government. In the late 1800s and the early 1900s, there were a bunch of Indian schools set up by the government. And the point of these schools was to scrub these kids of their native culture. They thought they'd be better Americans if they assimilated to American culture. So they were, many of these schools, they were punished for speaking their native languages. And I've heard from people that, you know, this would be the generation of the grandparents or the great-grandparents of people that are alive now. But I've heard from many people that they're grandparents or great-grandparents did not teach them in the language because they were somehow had been taught to be ashamed of it. So that's a big part. And then just American culture has taken over many, you know, just like in the rest of Wisconsin, you just don't hear as much German as you did 100 years ago. It's just the American culture is dominant.
You know, why is this something that people are trying to preserve? It's something that you address inside of the article, mm-hmm. that the reason why people want to preserve the Ojibwe language is because it is integral to their culture.
Yeah. It's really a way of looking at the world. And so the natural world, one of the guys that I interviewed, Michael Sullivan, who's a PhD linguist up in Lukuduray, he assesses the language abilities of the kids in that school. And they'll talk about maple sugaring, which is one of the sort of the basic cultural activities that they do, or, you know, gathering wild rice. So there's specific Ojibwe words for that. But also Ojibwe is used, but it is also true of Potawatomi and Menominee. The language is used in their religious ceremonies. And it's the people who are who believe in those religions. You know, the ceremonies have to be in the native language. There's a guy named Jim Thunder who is an elder up in Forest County Potawatomi tribe. He says, when God doesn't hear our language spoken, he'll consider their tribe to be extinct. So it's spiritual matters and also, you know, cultural matters. It's the way that their culture, the lifeblood of their culture, the languages.
Yeah. Now, we've been talking about Wadugadadin.
Uh-huh.
But Wadugadadin is just part of a much larger cultural movement among many tribes. What are some of the other immersion schools that we have here in Wisconsin?
I wrote a good deal about the Menominee. A guy named Ron Korn Jr. trains people up there. He's the head of that language department is Joey Awanape. But anyway, in the last couple of years, they've been running an immersion daycare in which the teachers are all trained in Menominee. And like in Lukuduray, they speak only Menominee to their little kids. But they're all pleased with kids respond to orders or to requests. Even if they're not speaking yet, they respond to prompts in Menominee. You know, and Ron told me that when the kids are out and there's a get together, a tribal get together, the elders will speak to them, the kids in Menominee, and the kids will respond. So there's a lot of excitement about that, according to Ron.
We also have a program. We have a school here in the Milwaukee area, over in Franklin, which is taking a slightly different approach.
Yeah, it would be impractical for the Indian Community School, which is a beautiful campus out in Franklin. It would be impractical for them to do immersion programs. They teach every kid in that school takes a language. Currently, they've got Ojibwe, Menominee, and Oneida being taught there. I haven't checked in lately, but they were very close the last time I talked to them to adding Ho-Chunk, to adding a teacher of Ho-Chunk to the school. And so that would be good. That would be four languages. But it would be hard to get people to teach mathematics, you know, all the other language arts, and that sort of all those other grade school classes in the native language. So I don't think that they're graduating kids that are as proficient in their languages as the kids up in Lukuduray. But their goal now is to graduate kids that are conversational in the language, with the hope that some of those kids will be motivated enough to become fluent. And it's interesting, they told me that this is a fairly new curriculum that they're developing, or a new way of teaching. I don't think they use the word curriculum. But they did a tour of all the tribes in the state, and they told me that every one of those, they had, you know, discussions with all of them about, you know, what they should be doing here down in Milwaukee. And every conversation involved the importance of language for each of these tribes. So they took that to heart, and that's now their goal.
What is the hope for these programs moving forward? It seems like all of them are in very different stages of development. Especially when we're looking at a school like the Indian Community School, which serves so many different tribes.
Yeah, what is the goal? I guess the goal is to get, it's not just to learn the language. It's to be immersed in the culture. And so it's that each of these tribes is proud of their culture, and they want their kids to be proud of the culture. And, you know, in Indian country, there are many problems that, you know, alcohol and drugs and historically poverty, you know, it just makes sense for people to be proud of who they are and what their heritage is. And that's, you know, I'm a white guy, so I'm not sure I can speak properly on this. But I think, as I pointed out in the story, that there have been studies of people that speak a native language, and they found that people who do speak a native language in these tribal areas are less likely to be suicidal, to use drugs, and even less likely to have diabetes. I don't know how that works, but that's what the studies say. So there's many benefits even beyond just knowing your language and your culture.
Yeah. Well, Tom Tolan, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, I was happy to be here, Joy. Thanks.
Tom Tolan is the managing editor for Milwaukee Magazine and the author of the article, Rekindling the Fires. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in April of 2019, and you can find a link to Tolan's article at wuwm.com. Next, we'll tell you about Waukesha native Donald Gerke, the man who invented SpaghettiOs, and why he deserves credit for many of the non-perishable foods we use today. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Canned and packaged comfort foods are making a comeback during the pandemic as more people turn to pantry staples. And even if it's been years since you've tasted SpaghettiOs, that jingle is probably ingrained into your brain.
When eating spaghetti, you can eat with a spoon. Uh-oh, SpaghettiOs!
You can thank Waukesha native and UW-Madison graduate Donald Gerke for that. He worked for Campbell's Soup Company for 35 years and had a huge impact not just on non-perishable foods, but pop culture. To learn more about SpaghettiOs and its creator, I'm joined by culinary historian and contributor Kyle Cherik.
Most people don't really realize, though, that SpaghettiOs was invented by a Waukesha boy. Most people know about Les Paul being the most famous son of Waukesha. My family jokes that it goes Les Paul, me, and then... and then Donald Gerke, who created SpaghettiOs, but others probably would argue that actually it's Les Paul, and then that's it. He was a Waukesha boy that grew up, went to Waukesha High, which is now South High School, went to Carroll College. It wasn't even known as Carroll College at the time. Then got his MBA in statistics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And his first real job, his first real out-of-college job employer was with Valentine Blatt's company as an analyst, a statistical analyst. And from there, he moved on to Campbell's Soup. And he moved up through the ranks. And it was in the 50s when they said, in essence, we need something to compete with this great spaghetti product that Chef Boyardee has. And hey, Gerke, go. And they tested all kinds of things as far as types of pastas. They tried pasta in the shape of baseballs and pasta in the shape of stars and pasta in the shape of cowboys, which I would love. There's no actual, you know, data left of what that looked like, but I want to see the spacemen and the cowboy shapes of pasta. It's, yeah. And Gerke and his team eventually ended up with O's because they were basically really durable. They don't fall apart. And this was a big leap for Campbell's because they had made their name in condensed soups and they had been part of the war effort, just as Boyardee had been. And I'll get into that story in a little bit. But a lot of these processed foods and big food that evolved in the 50s When Jacques Pepin first came here in the late 50s, early 60s, he came actually to create fairly quick meals and delicious meals for Howard Johnson's. A lot of people don't realize that this famous French chef was brought in by another famous French chef to create quick meals that could be served. Howard Johnson's was at the time the biggest hotel chain in America. And when he came here, he said, you know, there was so much variety in food in America, but I couldn't get fresh green beans. The only place I could get them was in cans. And so the Clarence Bird's Eyes of the World and the Campbell Soups and the Boyardee's really changed the food palette for America during that time. And a big part of it was because GIs returned en masse and had a taste for this. They had been eating these sauces, these tomato sauces, these cheese sandwiches, these, you know, insert this type of peanut butter in their K rations. And they came back and this tasted good to them.
On the note of taste, so one challenge that I can't quite complete either, but could you describe the taste of SpaghettiOs to someone who's never tasted it?
No, I can't, because it's the best of times. It's the worst of food. It is not tomato sauce.
Right. It's not marinara. It's not tomato. Yeah. From what I recall, it's kind of smoky in a weird way, but not, I don't know. What's your best?
You know, what it is it's SpaghettiOs. I mean, it's sort of the way that Xerox is now, you know, what you say for copying things, and Kleenex is a facial tissue. And I mean, SpaghettiOs is their own category. And I think they deserve some sort of cultural award, because they created a category when really they were just trying to compete with another actual Italian chef's recipes that were known nationally in Chef Boyardee. And he did a kind of a spaghetti product and sauce. His original move was he had meal kits where he would send the sauce and then the pasta in a separate kit and the seasonings, and you can combine it all together. This was prepared food that could be heated. The O's were where they landed, because they could be reheated multiple times. This is not an endorsement, by the way. Multiple times, and they would still hold up. And they were neat for kids, as opposed to, I have a 13-month-old, and when we feed her spaghetti in a sauce, we cut it up into even the smallest minute pieces, because otherwise it's just mayhem. It does not take rocket science to figure that out. So, you know, the long classic spaghetto noodle just wasn't going to cut it.
Right. And I imagine there's a big amount of science went into developing a noodle O that doesn't turn into mush. I imagine the pasta that's in SpaghettiOs is not the same as the pasta you would cook in boiling water.
Oh yeah, no, there's no question. Yeah, true science has to come into everything, from their condensed soups to Donald Gerke was also, of course, behind SpaghettiOs, and then Chunky Soup, which is now a brand name. I mean, by the time Chunky was celebrating a significant anniversary in 1990, it was grossing $500 million a year in sales for Campbell's Soup. And, you know, it's so funny, because I was mentioning some of these facts to my wife, and she said, "What's Chunky Soup?" And I was like, oh my God, if you grew up in, you know, she's younger than I am, but commercials in the 80s and 90s with the NFL players eating soup on the side of the game, saying that their moms were happy that they got their meat and vegetables. That was all Gerke's perspective. Like, that's, he told the agency, get these NFL players. The guy was a real marketing and culinary, in quotes, genius, in the sense that he created so more than 100 products for Campbell's, and a number of them are just iconic. And strangely enough, then they moved him on to the dog food division. But as a result, one of his mastermind moves was to sponsor the television show Lassie. So he really understood people and culture, and he became essentially a brand ambassador for Campbell's Soup. He was charming. He was affable. He was funny. He was, you know, he was at the Oscars awards, and he was at the, met President Reagan during the 80s, and he was on the Today Show. And I mean, he was the guy that if Campbell's had a press call, they wanted Don out there in front talking about, and he was enthusiastic, and he had developed many of these things from the idea stage into, basically millions of cans in people's cupboards. And really moved culturally through the advancements in American food, if you want to call it advancements. But during his tenure, Campbell's went from only condensed soups to prepared foods in a can to microwavable. And, you know, that's sort of like Wright brothers to landing on the moon within packaged foods. Not that I'm endorsing any of it. I'm just saying this happened. And as a culinary historian, this is really fascinating stuff to me.
Well, and especially considering he had 35 years at Campbell's to develop so many things like that. And his impact on food, not just food, but the fact that there's Warhol paintings of Campbell's soup and commercials, Lassie, you know, who would have thought SpaghettiOs could be the diving board to launch into so much more of influence on pop culture?
It's a testament to a different era in our economy where being a company person really meant that you could actually have a lot of effect in certain ways on, I don't think anybody ever expected the culture in this way. He never did, but you really could have profound effects. And Campbell's was, you know, when we talk about big food now with ConAgra and others, I mean, Campbell's still is, but was, as you're evincing, Andy Warhol, you know, chose the Campbell soup cans because it was so de rigueur for every American household. It didn't matter what your income strata was. It didn't matter what your life experience. Folks living in dire poverty in Appalachia and folks living in Newport mansions had cans of Campbell soup in their cupboard. So it represented something in that way. And exactly to your point, and he was part of that trajectory for us. The history of it goes back. It's really interesting. It's one chef sort of seamlessly and unknowingly handing it on to another. The most famous chef, one of the most famous chefs in all of history, Auguste Escoffier, was the chef that first, among doing amazing, you know, creating amazing cuisine and basically our sense of what is luxury dining with the Ritz, Irv Ritz, his partner, and all of the hotels they founded. When the chefs went down, sadly, and died on the Titanic, he had outfitted, planned those kitchens and hired everyone when he was the nth degree of what great cooking was. He also, the kitchens that that Gerke would have developed all these products in were essentially designed by Auguste Escoffier, in that he laid out what the modern kitchen looks like in the brigade system. But he was the first chef to package tomatoes in a can. He was the first chef to create freeze-dried gravies that then you added elements to, and you know, you could really spruce up. He was the first chef to advocate for healthcare and all kinds of other benefits. He was the first chef to insist that women should be eating in restaurants, which wasn't the norm at the time. When he cooked on the first grand ocean liner, Kaiser Wilhelm was in the retinue, and he asked who had done the meals, and Escoffier came out and he said, "I'm the emperor of Europe, but you're the emperor of chefs." I mean, it was at that level. And so that technology then translated to Chef Boyardee, who we know it as a B-O-Y-A-R-D-E-E, but he actually spelled it B-O-I-A-R-D-I. Totally different, but he understood marketing, just like Gerke did. And he had cooked, it's really kind of great because he had cooked at the Plaza Hotel in New York, then opened up his own restaurant in Cleveland. And his pasta sauces were so popular that he started packaging them along with the noodles and so forth. And then he moved and opened up a factory in Pennsylvania. And they were a major supplier for GIs. They had a massive war contract. So those flavors of inexpensive, really durable pasta and red sauce that will last forever in a can all across, you know, whether you're fighting in Iwo Jima or at the steps of Berlin, those are the flavors that the GI came to love. And during the decommissioning after World War II, he had a really amazing opportunity because we'll hear a lot of economists talk about now after World War II, when all these industries decommissioned, they compare that to the job losses that we're seeing now with the coronavirus. He basically was going to lay off thousands of people. And instead he said, you know what, I'm going to sell the company. I've grown this. It was my baby, but I can't let these people lose their jobs. And so Campbell's was, in that spirit, competing exactly with those flavors. And along comes Gerke. And you know, the song that was sung, the Oh SpaghettiOs, was sung by a very popular folk singer at the time. And it's a really kind of interesting, I mean, it's sort of a negative, you know, like, Oh SpaghettiOs is not, it's a counterintuitive. This is not an endorsement, but it caught on, and it caught on with kids. And it's a strange thing to me that a flavor memory that came out of a K-ration for military folks is now what's considered comfort food for a lot of Americans. It's almost an indulgence to have a can of SpaghettiOs now.
Right. And I was thinking, like, when was the last time I had a can of SpaghettiOs? And probably grade school, but I'm thinking maybe my next assigned grocery trip, maybe getting a can just to celebrate Gherky.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 50 years. Think of how many products haven't changed, and you wouldn't want them to, over a 50-year span in really any industry. You know, like the light bulb, right? The incandescent light bulb, SpaghettiOs. You know, even the Frisbees evolved, right? It's, you know, it's a pretty powerful testament to just the uniqueness and the how endearing it is over time.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is a culinary historian and essayist. We spoke in May of last year. That's Lake Effect for today. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you missed any of the conversations this week on Lake Effect, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Be sure to join us again tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.